So there are two names, significantly, that our people are called. Two names for the kingdoms, two names for the dual kingdoms eventually, more or less. Yisrael, Israel, Jacob's sobriquet after his name changed. And Judah, that's where the Jewish people comes from. I think it's Greeks who call us after the land of Judah. And Yisrael, of course, is the God fighter, the one who wrestles and struggles with God, which is a great moment in theology, as we were discussing in Judaism 101 some 6 days ago. That is a great sensibility for our people. And I'm not criticizing other religions, but for example, Islam means the submission, one who submits to God, but we would never stand up for that. Too much chutzpah amidst us. Yisrael, the God fighter. But the other name we don't think about as often in terms of its etymology is Yehuda, Judah, Leah's son. And there is a great passage in Talmud that notes the uniqueness of this moment that she gives him. We have all the etymologies for all the names, but one, I think, in this week's parsha. And Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Shimon Bar Yochai, from the day that the Holy Blessed One created the world, there was no person who'd offered thanks to God until Leah came at the birth of Judah and said, she became pregnant again, bearing a son, and she said, this time I will thank God. Thanking God for God's role in her fecundity, in the richness of her life that we described a little earlier, in the blessings of family and community, descendants, people you mentor, disciples, all of that, that richness of shared family and community. So this being Thanksgiving, it seemed very apt to talk about gratitude. Some would say the spiritual virtue par excellence, the first spiritual virtue we ought to cultivate. Because with gratitude, the suffering, the difficulties of life are much easier to bear. If we can focus on the positive and acknowledge God's role in the joyful moments of our life. And I want to speak about that with one particular and perhaps slightly unusual angle, gratitude of place. We're grateful for gifts we get. We're grateful for a good grade, a promotion, good salary, publication. We aren't that often grateful for a place. We don't think about it so clearly. One of the experiences people have when they go to Israel is that gratitude for a Jewish homeland, but also because it's quite beautiful, especially if you go to Lebanon border on the coast. There's a place called Rosh HaNikra, which is a series of grottos that's just breathtaking. And many other sites in Israel, and even in this country, Montana, Glacier National Park, Townsend, quite lovely places. Pardon? Zion. Yeah. Zion National Park and Zion, Israel, yes. So I don't know what your Thanksgivings were like, but I spent them with a friend in a rural area of Upper East Tennessee, and after eating far too much, as is most people's wont on Thanksgiving, I had to sit outside to digest. Didn't really help, but it seems to have a placebo effect on my stomach. And watch the sunset, watch the crinkles and crenellations of the trees, and felt intense gratitude to be in East Tennessee. We don't acknowledge that all the time. There are just some beautiful vistas. Great people, great opportunities here. You start with the sun sphere and move out from there. My son is really passionate about the sun sphere. And I don't know if you woke up in time. If you had small children, you certainly woke up in time to see the sunrise today. I don't recommend getting up that early, but I do recommend watching the sunrise. We can see it from our porch, and it was fabulous. It was fabulous. That sensibility that places affect our soul, that the richness of a place, its joys and beauties and celebrations and gifts, is something we ought to give gratitude to and something that spiritually uplifts us, was known even in the Talmud. I mean, of course, the place they always spoke about was Israel, the Zion, not Zion, Utah, although that is a phenomenal place also. And in Talmud, they note that the very air of the land of Israel makes one wiser, which is more or less the message I want to give you today. that you can learn from a place, and by giving gratitude to the place in which you live, by blooming where you're planted, so to speak, your soul can be enriched. There's another expression by Hafiz, the Sufi writer, that wherever you are, God drew a circle on the map. I feel that way often. Let's talk about place and the power of place, which we don't acknowledge. Our home, the joy of the physical space in which we live, the joy of house and home, which are in some ways different things, the joy of community and city and region, country, with all of its blessings and flaws. So in one of the most incredible, really touching passages, Jacob is fleeing, and he curls up on the rock, and he has a dream of the angels ascending and descending. It's not actually a ladder. It's a curlicue, a helter-skelter, I think is what that's called in Britain. And that's the image that's intended. That seems to be the ancient Near Eastern image. He wakes up and says, "Achen yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh v'anuchi lo yadati." The Holy One, the Almighty, was in this place, yet I was unaware. That's the secret. And that's the gentle touch you need to have wherever you go. That mantra of Hafiz, that wherever you go, God drew a circle on the map. That you are in a special place already, even in the pew in which you sit. So our sages note about Jacob's dream and later revelation, and he dedicates that spot to God, and some would say that's the cornerstone of the temple, that they put in his mind, our medieval sages, or in his mouth, "If I had known that this was a holy site, I wouldn't have chosen this site to sleep on. Surely the eternal is in this site, is in this place. Not as I thought when I lay down here, I thought that this was a profane place, but yes, now I see it's a holy place. And if I'd realized the special distinction of the site, I would have prepared myself mentally for such divine revelation." Other sages say it's possible that this dream he has of the angels is the beginning of his prophetic calling. He had not been aware of the sanctity of the space until his dream, but it was the first time that God revealed God's self to Jacob. In the very soil. That's the message of labor Zionism, that the soil has revelation for you, that the beams of your house have revelation for you, that the beams, the posts, the light of a synagogue have revelation for you. If you remember, I don't know if some of you will, Mike might, Mary Linda might, others of you when you visited for the first time, coming into this sanctuary for the first time, and the stillness and beauty of the air. Or in Jerusalem, the air is sort of dry and flavorful. Or maybe a moment at the gym where you just feel great about yourself. You go out for a run, you sit by the lake. We were at Cherokee Park yesterday, and I realized there's a spot where you have beautiful echoes. And I taught the kids about echoes, that geography and topography give you something. And you might not know they're holy until after the experience, but the key is to put on those glasses, those lenses, to see the holiness of the place in which you are. We can spend, I remember someone saying this when I came to visit an interview, there was someone, I was very frustrated by this experience, saying that they were unsettled here. You know, young professionals are often unsettled where they find themselves and don't paint their house, don't ever really move in because they expect to move along. That's no way to live. Has anyone had the experience of living somewhere and you know that a sectional sofa, for instance, would look really good, but you keep thinking, I'm not going to move. This isn't my full-time place. I'm eventually going to have a different house or move on to a different job so I don't settle in. And then when you leave, this is, I guess I'm looking at your expressions, this doesn't happen to you, but it's happened to me more than once. And you leave that job, for example, and you think, I wasted so much time not being comfortable in my office, not making it a home. So there's a concept that this spot that Jacob acknowledges for its holiness becomes the site of the temple, becomes the foundation stone of the temple. But there's another mystical concept, and Rashi quotes this through Midrash, that there is another temple. Just as there is a Torah that we roll and read and scroll and scribe, there is a Torah that is heavenly, that transcends time, space, and writing and orthography. Likewise, there is a heavenly temple that transcends the boundaries, the courtyards, the Holy of Holies of the physical temple that was in Jerusalem, or the tabernacle in the wilderness, that there is a corresponding space in the metaphysical realm to every physical object we have. Somewhat of a Platonic idea. That's the effort, to sort of see through and transcend physical limitation and to see greater teaching, greater Torah, greater wisdom and instruction for us, and to recognize that where you live is full of grace. So our Midrashim, the Midrash on Psalms, and elsewhere in Talmud kind of speak about a concept. And we see this in a Haftarah, I think it's in the middle of Leviticus, it's a great Haftarah about David requesting to build the temple. What does it take to bring God down to earth? What does it take for God to create a temple that God might dwell among us? This piece, this recognition of Hafiz's mantra, that where you are, there is a circle on the map, that you ought and have to bloom where you're planted. There's no point in thinking about the next place you live or the last house you had or the next job you'll have or the next wife or previous love, that the home and family and profession and passion that you have is where you ought to be now. And unless you embrace that, unless you see the glory and grace of that, you probably will never really be happy. Well, certainly restlessness and dissatisfaction is ambition, and ambition is valuable. But beyond the needs of ambition, constantly struggling and dreaming of the next is spiritually destructive. The trick is to see the place you're in as the sacred place. So the Midrash says, it's like a king who had three people that loved him. And so he was going to build a palace, and I guess the implication is the king thought, where will I build this? Who will help me lay the cornerstone? Who will help me set up my palace? Who will be the first visitor and resident of this holy place? So the first lover, the first beloved, replied to him, I know the place you were going to work on used to be a mountain. The king thinks, no, it's not a good site. And he goes to the second, and the second one says, I think it used to be a field. No, I don't want to build it. That's not a special place. And the king called to the third beloved, the third friend, the third intimate friend, and said, I want to build a palace here where you are. And the third friend says, it was a palace in a previous generation. And so our sages note this with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that Abraham describes a place like a mountain, and Isaac experiences God in a field, but Jacob talks about, after this dream, seeing God in a sacred palace, being in the place of God. That's, God is where you see God. God is where you put God. Oh, wow, I didn't expect to go this way. Neil Gilman, I don't know if any of you have read his writing, he just died. He's one of my first mentors. He's the reason I got published, actually, because he would nudge the publisher to get me out. Was he here? I'm very lucky. My mother was awed by his intellect, and to me, he was just a sweet person who smoked a pipe. Kind of squeaky voice, but very, very kind and very good to me. That was something he said, God is where you put God. That's it. That's the trick in life, to bring God with you, to carry the Mishkan, the tabernacle in your heart. So this is, you go back to that phrase, Achen yesh Adonai b'makom hazeh, b'makom. Makom is a place, but our sages use it as a term for God, both making midrash on this verse and really just using it as a sort of a metonymy for the omnipresent God. When you say place and you use it to describe God, or even if you're accidentally using the word, what you're describing is the omnipresence of God. So in our Midrashim, they say, how did this become a name for God, the place? Rabbi Yossi ben Halafta said that we don't know whether God is the place of God's world or whether God's world is God's place. But when the verse states in Exodus, there is a place with me, it follows that God is the place of God's world, but God's world is not God's place. Which is, as we talked about in Judaism 101, the theology called panentheism. That this whole place is God's, but God is not just this place. And that's the striving that I want to leave you with today. in Knoxville, Farragut, Upper East Tennessee, Heska Amuna Synagogue, the Jewish community here. Don't waste too much time thinking about what else there is. Your home, your family, your work. Don't think about constantly imagining writing a resume. Think about blooming where you're planted, finding God within the place where you are. And if you do, no other place really matters.